So today is the auspicious appearance day of Lord Varaha. And I thought it might be useful today for me to read the summary that I have made of this particular rather lengthy story, and have summarized it into a few pages into my book. Some of you have already read this book, Mystical Stories from the Bhagavatam. For those of you who may be listening online, it starts on page 11 on that particular book. It's rather dramatic and very absorbing and interesting. And it follows the narration of the Bhagavatam faithfully, only it abridges it somewhat so that we can have the overview of the entire pastime just in these few pages. So without any further ado, try my best to read it and try to recap the feelings, the emotions of this most marvelous pastime. It's definitely full of excitement, full of fury, and full of dynamism. It's very, very compelling. It beats out any of the Hollywood movies, for sure. I'm surprised they haven't made this into a Hollywood movie. It has so many twists and turns and so many interesting sidelights. So we begin. Story is entitled, it's chapter 2, Hiranyaksha Challenges God. As the sun sank behind the verdant hills on one of the heavenly planets, Diti, a beautiful goddess, intensely desired to have union with her husband, Kashyapa. An extremely learned and enlightened man, he was known as a great sage, having just completed his evening oblations, pouring grains and clarified butter into a sacrificial fire. He was now sitting cross-legged on a kusha grass mat and facing a silently moving river. His grave eyes were closed and his firm body still as he meditated deeply on the divine. Diti gazed at him longingly. She noted his handsome face with its black beard and mustache, his flowing shoulder-length hair, his bare manly chest and his sturdy legs beneath his thin white dhoti. She wanted to tell him how aroused she was, but she hesitated, unwilling to disturb his deep meditation. Now somebody has to fix this. This is falling down. Somebody come here. It's just going to fall down. It's got to be tightened over here someplace. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. Yeah, he fixed it fine. Oh, better? Okay. Thank you. Let me go with that paragraph again. Diti gazed at him longingly. She noted his handsome face, and I already described that. After all, was her desire to have union more important than his desire to commune with God? Of course not. And yet she found herself unable to suppress this surging, overpowering force any longer. As she began walking towards Kashyapa, she sensed a fragrant breeze on her face and body, saw a pair of green flirting parrots flying nearby, and heard a medley of crowing peacocks in the distance. Sitting down before her still husband, she looked at him helplessly and then said loudly, "I'm sorry to bother you," but he opened his eyes curiously. "But I'm very agitated." "Agitated?" he asked. "Sorry." "Yes." He stared at her pleading eyes. "Please satisfy me so that I can have a son." "Of course, but let's wait a while." "No, I don't want to wait." All my co-wives have sons, but you haven't given me any. Just be patient. I've been just as faithful to you as they, haven't I? Of course. Then please bless me with sons, now. I think we should wait a few seconds, otherwise people will criticize me. Why? Lord Shiva will be passing by in a few moments with his devotees. So? So it would be very disrespectful if we engaged in sexual intercourse now. Dithi was losing her patience. He reminded her, Lord Shiva is extremely powerful and very easily offended. She wondered whether Lord Shiva might punish her for such an offense. Therefore, let's wait till after he passes. But Dithi couldn't wait a second longer. Losing all reason and control, she clutched at her husband's dhoti and, like a shameless prostitute, dragged him to a secluded bush. Her lust was so overwhelming that it equally engulfed and submerged Kashyapa. Yielding to its irresistible force, he lay down with his wife and fully gratified her desire. Several minutes later, Kashyapa left his wife's side and entered the river to bathe. Then he meditated on the eternal effulgence and recited the Gayatri Mantra. Dithi was now feeling ashamed of herself. Why had she become so demanding and impetuous? Why hadn't she waited as her wise husband had advised? Wondering whether Lord Shiva would punish her, she anxiously waded to the river and halted beside Kashyapa. She didn't want to interrupt his meditation, but now she felt so guilty and worried that she had to. My lord, she said loudly. He opened his eyes and looked at her inquisitively. I'm worried. I'm worried. Lord Shiva, out of anger, might kill my embryo. Kashyapa considered the possibility. But you could stop him by praying to him. Since you're a great devotee of his, he would listen to you. Trembling with fear, Dithi then offered prayers of glorification and repentance to Lord Shiva. After this, she felt regretful that she had again interrupted her husband's evening prayers. But what could she do, since more than anything else, she wanted to be a mother? Kashyapa peered into the future to ascertain the fate of their offspring. Will Lord Shiva kill our child? Dithi asked anxiously. No. No? Then he's forgiven me? Not exactly. What do you mean? You will give birth to two monstrous demons. Oh, no. Yes. And they will wreak havoc all over the universe. Dithi felt devastated, utterly heartbroken. Since she was a goddess, and since people at that time lived for many thousands of years, she suppressed the delivery of her babies for, anybody know how many years? For 100 years. However, the two demons in her womb, by their sinister influence, began to affect the whole cosmos. The light of the sun and moon became diminished, and darkness began to pervade the universe. This caused anxiety to many of the gods as they became hindered in their administrative work of creating weather, vegetation, minerals, jewels, etc. Unable to dispel the darkness, the disturbed gods traveled for guidance to the planet of Lord Brahma, the four-headed, four-armed chief god who creates the universe under Lord Vishnu's direction. They first offered him respectful obeisances and suitable prayers. Then they disclosed their sad plight and prayed to be able to resume their regular duties. But Lord Brahma explained to them the deeper underlying cause of the darkness. In essence, he told them, so now we enter into a flashback. Just prior to Dithi and Kashyapa engaging in their inauspicious union, something had happened in the eternal world. Far beyond the material universes, that world is inhabited by only exalted, pure-hearted souls. Their entire lives revolve around glorifying and serving the Supreme Lord Vishnu continuously. That domain is called Vaikuntha, or the realm of no anxiety. Since the residents there live in their original spiritual bodies, which are composed of eternal substance, they never die. Thus they dwell there fearlessly and lovingly, always thinking of how they may enhance God's never-ending pleasure. As a result of their pure, selfless lifestyle, they experience an ever-increasing amount of spiritual bliss and happiness at almost every moment. This is true not only of those beings occupying human-like bodies, but also of those inhabiting animal, plant, fruit, and bird bodies. All beings there are spiritually intelligent and equally conscious, and each person renders service to God in his or her own special way. In Vaikuntha, there is no need for sexual intercourse, as it is known in the material world. For the quality and intensity of pleasure derived from loving devotional service to the Lord is infinitely greater. Persons in the material world who have attained spiritual perfection, pure love of God, are promoted to Vaikuntha when they leave their physical bodies. Such persons have no selfish motivation, such as the desire to be beautiful, wealthy, powerful, knowledgeable, or famous. Moreover, they possess all good qualities, such as kindness, affection, humility, gravity, and friendliness, and are fully satisfied by just serving and glorifying God. Lord Brahma's mind-born sons, the four Kumaras, Sanaka, Sanatan, Sanandan, and Sanat Kumara, were such persons. They were Brahma's first offspring. Although they were the oldest and among the wisest person in the material world, they chose to appear as naked 5-year-old children. Self-realized and God-realized, the Kumaras, by their mystic powers, travel throughout the material and spiritual universes, instantly appearing or disappearing from wherever they chose. One day they desired to visit the Supreme Lord Vishnu in Vaikuntha. Although in meditation they had experienced his eternal effulgence as well as his attractive form, they had never actually met him personally. Thus they were extremely eager to do so now. The four sages were highly famous in both the material and spiritual worlds. When they arrived at the entrance of Vaikuntha, they had to pass through 7 gold and diamond gates before they could enter the Lord's opulent palace. Quickly recognizing them, the guards at each of the first 6 gates gladly granted them admittance. However, when the Kumaras approached the 7th gate, the 2 guards there, Jaya and Vijaya, did not recognize them. Considering them to be trespassers, the guards with their large clubs blocked them from entering. Anxious to see the Lord, the Kumaras stared at the guards angrily. The resplendent, youthful watchmen were handsome, four-armed, blue-complexioned, flower-garlanded, and adorned with valuable jewelry. In fact, they closely resembled in face and body the supremely attractive Lord Vishnu, as did all male human-like inhabitants there. The Kumaras knew that the Lord was always ready and eager to welcome pure souls into his domain. So they were quite peeved by the disdainful treatment they had just received. Therefore, they began to discuss this amongst themselves. "This is completely improper," said Sanandan. "It is," replied Sanaka. "These guards are supposed to have the same nice qualities as the Lord." "But they don't," added Sanat Kumara. "They're acting just like envious materialists." "Yes, they are," concurred Sanaka. "I don't think they belong here," stressed Sanandan. "Neither do I," replied Sanaka. "Actually, I think they're imposters." "They must be. And they probably think we are too," responded Sanatan. "Then we should punish them, and right now," said Sanaka. "Yes, let's send them to the material world where they belong," Sanatan emphasized. Then the Kumaras, as a single body, cursed the guards accordingly. The gatekeepers suddenly realized from the authoritative and powerful manner of the Kumaras that they were not at all mischievous children, but were great sages. Overwhelmed with fear, the watchmen threw themselves at the Kumaras' feet and begged for mercy. Jaya said, "You have justly punished us for disrespecting you. We should not have acted that way." "But please," added Vijay, "when we fall to the material world, please don't let us forget the Lord." The gatekeepers, despite their offense, were great devotees of God, and they never wanted to forget Him, no matter where they went. At that moment, the Supreme Lord, accompanied by His beautiful wife, the goddess Lakshmi, and fanned by His attendants with yak-tail whisks, appeared there. He had already heard from his servants about the guards' insult to the Kumaras. When the four sages saw the Lord, they were intensely captivated by his exquisite beauty. Indeed, he was even more beautiful than his stunning wife. As he rested one of his four hands on the shoulder of his eagle carrier, Garuda, and twirled a lotus flower in another hand, his affectionate smile and glance deeply touched the Kumaras' hearts. They gazed with thirsty eyes at his blackish countenance, bejeweled golden crown, broad chest, yellow garments, charming necklace, and garland of flowers. Their eyes unsated, they blissfully bowed their heads at his lotus-like feet. As a gentle breeze blew the fragrance of the tulsi leaves from the toes of the Lord's feet to the Kumara's eager nostrils, the sages became overwhelmed with bliss and happiness, far more than they had ever experienced in their meditation on the Lord's infinite light. It was a truly transformational experience. Drinking in God's personal sweetness, beauty, and goodness, they wanted only to serve and glorify Him forever. Thus, devotional prayers, pregnant with humility and gratitude, flowed sweetly from their pure mouths. And the more they lauded Him, the more ecstatic they felt. Lord Vishnu congratulated them for their sweet words and then said, "My guards, Jaya and Vijaya, have greatly offended you. Therefore, I approve of your punishment for them. Since they are my attendants, their offense has become my offense." "No, Lord," protested Sanandan. "Yes, it has. I thus seek your forgiveness. It pains me to see devotees like you offended." The Lord glanced at the gatekeepers and then back to the Kumaras. "Since these guards have rendered fine service to me, I would appreciate if you would do me a favor." "Anything, Lord," said Sanat Kumara. "After they've suffered in the material world, would you please allow them to return here soon?" "Surely," said Sanaka. "However, it seems to me now that we've cursed two faultless persons." "Yes," added Sanandan, "for anyone serving you here is incapable of committing any fault." "That's true," smiled the Lord. "Actually, this situation was completely prearranged by me." "Prearranged?" asked the Kumaras, puzzled. "Yes. Why? Why would you want your devotees to fall to the material world?" asked Sanaka. The Lord smiled affectionately at them. "In due course of time, you will understand this mystery." The Kumaras, out of respect, joined their palms prayerfully, circled him three times reverently, offered him obeisances, and then departed from Vaikuntha. The Lord turned to Jayan Vijay. "You should leave for the material world now, but you need not fear." Is that applause out there? Or is it a curse? "But you need not fear. Actually, I could have nullified the sage's curse, but I didn't because it's part of a larger plan that I have. Now you have a choice. You can stay in the material world three lifetimes as my enemy, or 7 years as my friend. Take your pick." The guards look baffled. You'll understand later when you return here. So they chose to stay in the material world as an enemy of the Lord because they wanted to return to the spiritual world as fast as possible. Now go, said the Lord. Leaving the eternal world, Jai and Vijay became morose, and their beauty and luster diminished as they fell towards the material world. The Kumaras again approached them. After you take birth three times, said Sanaka, our curse will end. At that time, you return to Vaikuntha. They were reassuring. As Jai and Vijay entered the material atmosphere, they were flooded with ignorance and passion. This meant that when they would take birth, they would have no recollection whatsoever of their life in the eternal world as God's servants. Instead, they would become fully preoccupied with acquiring pleasure and power or trying to become God. So Lord Brahma concluded his explanation to the gods. The souls of those two gatekeepers have been in Diti's womb for the past 100 years. You're disturbed because their power in the form of darkness has minimized yours. True, but isn't there something we can do to overcome it? Asked one of the gods. No, said Lord Brahma, because it's something desired by God. Therefore, he will rescue us when he wants to. Understanding the situation, yet feeling heartened and confident, the gods offered their thanks and respects to Lord Brahma and returned to the respective planets. When Diti finally gave birth to the two demons, many fearsome and wondrous disturbances occurred in nature. There were earthquakes, hurricanes, fires, lightning, and thunder. Excuse me. Unfavorable planets like Saturn appeared brightly, while comets and meteors fell swiftly. Masses of dense clouds hid the luminaries, and thick darkness reigned everywhere. The ocean, with its giant waves, wailed loudly, and in the villages, jackals howled ominously. Dogs barked, asses brayed, owls hooted, birds shrieked, and trees fell. Terrified cows yielded blood instead of milk, and temple deities shed profuse tears. Everyone everywhere was horrified and terrified, for they thought that the world was about to end. Kashyapa named his younger son Hiranyaksha and the older one Hiranyakashipu. The two demons grew up rapidly. Their steel-like bodies became so tall that the crests of their golden crowns seemed to kiss the sky. They sported golden anklets, shining bracelets, colorful garlands, and beautiful sashes. Resting their huge clubs on their shoulders, they stomped along angrily, shaking the earth with their every step. Hiranyaksha was always ready to please his older brother by his deeds. Thus, by his mystic powers, this blonde-haired demon with small tusks wandered all over the cosmos in a fighting spirit. Tremendously powerful, both physically and mentally, Hiranyaksha was extremely proud. When he challenged the mighty gods to a fight, they fled in panic and disappeared. Believing he was invincible, the demon roared loudly with delight. After Hiranyaksha returned from the heavenly realm, for the sake of sport, he angrily dived into the deep ocean. There he roared so terrifyingly that all the aquatics, dreadfully alarmed, swam far away from him. The demon played in the ocean for many, many years, repeatedly smiting gigantic waves with his iron mace. Finally, he reached Vibhavari, the watery home of the god Varuna, lord of the aquatic creatures and guardian of the lower regions of the universe. Hiranyaksha first offered him his respects. Then, desiring to prove his supremacy, he smiled and mocked him. O great lord, you're a famous warrior. You've conquered all the gods and demons. You've performed big sacrifices. Now fight with me. Perceiving that the demon's vanity knew no bounds, Varuna became angry. Nonetheless, he managed to restrain his wrath and diplomatically said, "Oh, dear one, I've grown too old for warfare. Thus, I've stopped fighting." "Stop?" Hiranyaksha was surprised. "Yes, but you're so skilled that I think only Lord Vishnu could satisfy you. So why don't you challenge him?" "Lord Vishnu?" "Yes, he's much more your match." "All right, then I will." Learning from the sage Narada where Lord Vishnu was, Hiranyaksha hastened to the Garbhodak ocean at the bottom of the universe. Now it so happened that while Hiranyaksha had been terrorizing the universe, he had excavated and stolen for his own selfish purposes all the gold that existed in the earth. This caused an ecological imbalance, dislocating the earth from its orbit. The earth then fell through space, splashed into the Garbhodak ocean, and sunk into the bottom. When Lord Brahma learned of this, he became very concerned. Many human beings and animals would have to be born on earth, but its watery environment now made it uninhabitable for them. He therefore spent much time pondering how to lift it out of the ocean. Hoping that the Supreme Lord would direct him, Lord Brahma, surrounded by some of his enlightened sons, suddenly noticed something very strange. A tiny boar, no larger than the upper portion of a thumb, flew out of one of his nostrils. The boar then rose into the sky and grew to the size of an elephant. Brahma was astonished. Looking at his sons, he asked, "Is he some great person pretending to be a boar? Just look at him. One moment he's tiny and the next he's huge. Could he be the Supreme Lord Vishnu?" As Lord Brahma discussed this with his sons, the boar tumultuously roared once, then again, his uncommon voice echoing in all directions. Recognizing the auspicious sound to be that of Lord Vishnu, known in this form as Lord Varaha, the boar, the sages began to chant Vedic hymns in praise of him. In reply to their prayers, the Lord roared again and flew into the sky, his hard hairs quivering. He waved his tail about and with his hooves and glittering white tusks scattered the clouds in the sky. After he glanced over his supplicating devotees, who felt transcendental pleasure in seeing him, the Lord dove into the ocean and tried to find the earth by smell. After swimming to the bottom, the Lord saw the earth resting there. He then easily set it on his tusks and swam with it up to the surface. Indeed, he looked magnificent. And you just picture this. The whole earth sitting on the tusks of a boar. Can you imagine the size of this boar? At that moment, wearing stunning golden armor and a wealth of ornaments, Hiranyaksha arrived. Seeing the Lord and envying his splendor, the demon laughed, "Ha, ha, ha, an amphibious beast." It's one who can live on water and the land. Then he looked sternly at Lord Varaha and shouted, "This earth belongs to us, the demons, so don't think you can take it while I'm here." But the Lord disregarded him. "You rascal," bellowed the demon, "today I will smash your head with my club and kill you." Tolerating this verbal abuse, the Lord noted that Mother Earth was frightened. Thus he rose out of the water and placed the earth on the surface, empowering her to float. As he did, the demon thought the Lord was trying to flee from him. So he chased him, roaring thunderously and yelling, "Look at you, running away from battle. Aren't you ashamed?" "Well," replied the Lord sarcastically, "I'm a jungle beast, and I'm looking for hunting dogs like you. So give up your beautiful talk, your boastful talk, and try to kill me. Come on, just try." angry and agitated, Hiranyaksha moved like a challenged cobra. Hissing indignantly, the demon quickly sprang toward the Lord and tried to hit him in the chest with his powerful club. But the Lord skillfully dodged the violent blow, just as an adept yogi eludes death. As Lord Varaha expressed his anger and rushed toward Hiranyaksha, the latter bit his lip and repeatedly brandished his club. Then the Lord, with his mace, struck Hiranyaksha on his right temple. However, the demon, with his own club, protected himself. Thus, Diti's son and Varaha, enraged and seeking victory, pounded each other with their huge maces. The rivalry between the combatants was terrific. Each bore injuries on his body from the blows of the other's pointed club, and each grew more furious due to the smell of his own blood. Both eager to win, they performed various dexterous maneuvers, looking like two horrendous bulls contesting for a cow. Lord Brahma then approached the Lord and pleaded, "Dear Lord, this monster has proved to be a threat to the gods, the holy men, the cows, and the innocent. He has unnecessarily harassed them and become quite fearsome. He wanders all over the world searching for someone to fight with." "Yes, yes, I know. He's arrogant, independent and wicked, and very skilled in trickery. The easiest time to kill him is during the day. But daytime is almost over. If you wait till nighttime, it will be harder, for demons are stronger then. Therefore, please kill him immediately." The Lord laughed heartily, and accepting Brahma's pure entreaty, glanced at him affectionately. Then Varaha aimed his mace at Hiranyaksha's chin. But the demon struck first, causing the Lord's blazing club to fall from his hand and whirl. However, Hiranyaksha did not try to take advantage of this, preferring fair combat. The Lord then invoked his blazing discus, and it began revolving in his hand. Watching the fight from the sky, the gods and the celestials cried to the Lord, "Victory! Kill him! Stop playing with him!" Feeling resentment, Lord Varaha bit his lip and then hissed like a serpent at Hiranyaksha, who gazed at him hotly. The Titan then jumped into the air, aimed his club at the Lord, and flung it forcefully. But the Lord knocked it down with his left foot. "Pick up your weapon and try again," he urged. Feeling challenged, Hiranyaksha recovered his mace, roared loudly, and again threw it. But the Lord caught it with the same ease that his eagle carrier, Garuda, seizes a snake. He then offered Hiranyaksha his club, but feeling frustrated and humiliated, the demon refused it. Instead, Diti's son grabbed a fiery trident and with all his strength angrily hurled it. But the Lord threw his flaming discus and smashed it, the trident scattering it to pieces. Enraged and bellowing, Hiranyaksha attacked the Lord, beating his hard fists against Varaha's broad chest. But the Lord felt no more pain than an elephant does when struck by a wreath of flowers. Then without warning, Hiranyaksha mystically vanished. However, for a few moments later, he conjured up an array of horrifying apparitions. When the celestials saw them, they were terrified, thinking that the end of the world was near. Fierce winds blew from all directions. Darkness spread everywhere, and dust and hail abounded. Stones flew from all corners. Thick black clouds manifested lightning and thunder. The sky rained pus, hair, blood, feces, urine, and bones. Mountains discharged weapons. Naked demonesses, their hair wildly disheveled, appeared holding tridents. Ruffian yakshas and rakshasas marching on foot or riding on horses, elephants, or chariots shouted cruel and savage slogans. Lord Varaha released his whirling discus at the apparitions, and they instantly disappeared. Then the Titan reappeared, but he was now so enraged so furious that he tried to embrace and crush the Lord. But as he squeezed mightily, much to his amazement, he saw the Lord standing outside the circle of his arms. Hiranyaksha then began to pummel the Lord with his hard fists, but Varaha indifferently slapped him at the root of his ear. But even though the slap was indifferent, it was so horrendously powerful that Hiranyaksha's body reeled. His eyeballs bulged out of their sockets. His arms and legs broke, and the hair on his head scattered about. Completely dazed and like a gigantic tree uprooted by a hurricane, he collapsed and died in the water. Hari Bol! I didn't hear you. Hari Bol! Come on, the biggest demon in the world has been killed. Yes. At that very moment, although far away, a shudder ran through the heart of Diti, his mother. As she recalled the prophecy of her husband, Kashyapa, blood flowed from her breasts. Lord Brahma and the other gods approached the scene, and they saw the demon lying on the water, biting his lips. There was still a faint glow on his face, and Lord Brahma admiringly said, "What a blessed death, to be killed by the Supreme Lord himself." The Lord struck him with his forefoot, and the demon died gazing at the Lord's face. How fortunate! Then one of the gods gratefully prayed, "Our dear Lord, we offer you our humble obeisances. This demon was a torment to all the worlds. Fortunately for us, you killed him. Now we can live in peace, perform our duties, and offer our devotion at your lotus-like feet." After all the other gods offered their prayers, the Lord returned to his abode in Vaikuntha. It has been said by great saints that if one hears, recites, or takes pleasure in this pastime of Lord Varaha, fighting and defeating Hiranyaksha, one is immediately relieved of the painful results due to occur. Of all one's past sinful activities, even the killing of a Brahmin, considered to be the most sinful. Moreover, one gains extraordinary spiritual merit, wealth, fame, longevity, and one's desired objects. And at that at the last moment of one's life, one is transferred to Lord's eternal transcendental world. All glories to Lord Varahara Ki Jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada has given us this wonderful, wonderful transcendental story. Ki. So I just have one or two quick comments to make. Some devotees may be wondering, because it's in very clearly written in Srila Prabhupada's wonderful purport as to why the Lord would even want to come down, as the question was asked, why he would want his devotees to go down to earth. And the reason that Srila Prabhupada gives is that the Lord has a sporting propensity, and that sporting propensity is expressed in fighting, you know, in wrestling. And who better to fight with than his own devotees? So in fighting, of course, that's a very close, very intimate, best way I can say it, very close, intimate pastime. And it's actually, one has to earn such a credit to be able to come close to the Lord and be embraced by the Lord as Hiranyaksha was in this particular pastime, and then got his ear slapped in addition. And as we can see, Lord Brahma, he was expressing the devotional sentiment, how fortunate, how lucky, how great this person is. He wasn't looking at it as some kind of a tragedy. He was looking at it as an auspicious occasion. So there is that very important point, that it is sporting. He doesn't want to fight out of hatred or to kill for its own sake, but merely because sporting is part of a man's nature. It just happens to be, to some extent, even a female's nature, but not as strongly. Are there any questions or any comments that any of us here would like to make on this particular very wonderful pastime? And I thank you all for sitting attentively throughout. I didn't see any yawns during the course, so that's quite flattering. Thank you. So, are there any questions or comments on that? I try to cover the entire story, leaving out, of course, certain important points. I do recommend that if you have any time today, please go to the Bhagavatam itself, and there you will read a lot more in depth about this pastime by Srila Prabhupada's many, many purports. If you have that time, please avail yourself of it, because I've just given an overview. Yes, Prabhuji. Does anybody have the microphone just for a moment? Because persons are listening on the internet and they like to hear your question.
I remember, Maharaj, that Lord Chaitanya also assumed a Varaha form in one occasion. Can you remind us about that occasion?
Not really. Lord Chaitanya assumed a number of appearances like that. He assumed also the appearance of Hiranyakashipu too. In fact, it was so terrifying to the residents there that they were fleeing in all directions because it was such a good imitation. Well, who could better do it than him? So then Lord Chaitanya, he stopped and he realized that, well, what am I doing? I'm here to bring, you know, compassion. I'm here to bring love. And look what I'm terrifying and frightening all my devotees and potential devotees. What a fool. He starts cursing himself. Or he starts condemning himself for doing that. So that's about all I can say. They often, Lord Chaitanya and his devotees would often put on little skits in which they would take different parts of Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda and enacting the different pastimes that are in the Bhagavatam, and especially those which are in the 10th canto, Krishna killing different demons like that. But I can't, other than that, I can't say anything. But the one thing that's being emphasized there is that the more we think of Krishna, the more we remember him, the more we go over those pastimes in our mind or read about them, the more purified we become in our hearts. And if we become purified in our hearts, then not only can we better appreciate these pastimes, but we develop more and more love for the Lord. And in developing that love for the Lord and expressing that love through devotional service, the Lord bestows his grace upon us in thankfulness, in gratitude, enabling us to come closer and nearer to him. So therefore, remembering, hearing, chanting, remembering these pastimes are extremely important. And as I read in the next to the last paragraph, every one of us who heard this, and even myself narrating it, has gotten some great blessing this morning because of the fact that it is all auspicious. So that's all I can say. Did you, someone else? Oh, I saw a hand there. Pardon, Prabhu? I'm not hearing. Oh, the canto? I can probably tell you that. If you just give me a moment, I think I can look it up. Yeah, I see it as the third canto. Yes. Looks like 13 to 19. That's what I have written down here. Hiranyaksha challenges God. 3:13:19. I'm not sure if that 3 is the canto or the chapter. So, no, the chapter is 13 to 19. And it must be, and it is the third canto. Okay? Any other question? No? Okay, everyone is excused. I know we're breaking a codicil now. Is there going to be regular breakfast? Anybody know? There will be. Okay. Thanks so much, Hare Krishna. And all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Ki Jai. All glories to Lord Varahara Ki.